We'll hear arguments next in a case which will commence at 1 o'clock. Harrison against PPG Industries, but we'll not ask counsel to fragment the argument by minutes. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This Court is quite familiar with the complexities of the Clean Air Act. In 1977, Congress substantially amended the Act, including the judicial review provisions of Section 307(b)(1). That section now gives original jurisdiction to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia to review the Administrator's actions under certain enumerated sections of the Act and other final actions which have nationwide application or effect. The regional courts of appeals are given original jurisdiction over other enumerated sections of the Act, and, quote, any other final action of the administrator under the Act, end quote, of local or statewide effect or application. We contend, EPA does, that Section 307(b)(1) means exactly what it says, that the courts of appeals have original jurisdiction to review all actions, all final actions by the administrator taken under the Act. And to explain this interpretation, first I'll discuss...
And that is to the exclusion of district courts, your position is?
Yes, Your Honor, right. Except for the provision under, the citizen supervision under Section 304.
Says so.
Right,
does
yes.
Does the legislative history reveal whether the authors of that amendment, all others, had any idea of the scope of its impact?
To some extent. Admittedly, the legislative history on Section 307(b)(1) is sparse.
Isn't very helpful, is it?
It's not extremely helpful, but it's not unhelpful either, Your Honor. It's obvious that Congress was most concerned with and addressed the problem of allocating venue between the Courts of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and the Regional Courts of Appeals. Congress did indicate, however, that they were placing review of all rules and orders of regional, statewide, or local application with the Regional Courts of Appeals. And this was an expansion of the jurisdiction under the 1977 amendments. Another significant fact is that the House report that this legislative history is in was addressing. At that point, the only amendment to what had been the prior Section 307(b)(1) was the any other final action language. So the legislative history was addressing that addition to Section 307(b)(1). So limited as the legislative history is, it does indicate that Congress was aware of an expansion of jurisdiction. I'd like to discuss the particular final action involved in this case and then explain why our interpretation is the most manageable, practical, and efficient way of interpreting Section 307(b)(1). In August 1971, the administrator promulgated proposed new source performance standards for stationary sources, which included emission limitations for sulfur dioxides. The statute at that time, and it still does as amended, defines new stationary sources to include sources which were modified or constructed after the date of the proposed regulations. And stationary sources were also defined to include fossil fuel-fired steam generating plants, such as PPG has at its Lake Charles, Louisiana facility. Now, in May 1975, EPA wrote PPG and asked that PPG provide additional, or not additional, but provide information as to the operation of its facility and what was included on the possibility that the new source performance standards might be applicable to the Louisiana facility. In May and in June of that year, PPG responded with their interpretation of whether the applications of the, whether the new source performance standards would apply or not. They provided detailed diagrams of their facility, purchase order as to when the different parts of the facility, because only one section of the overall facility, chemical manufacturing facility, was particularly involved. Purchase orders for those parts of it. In October of 1976, EPA concluded that the new source performance standards would be applicable to the facility because of the construction date, that they, construction had commenced after the date of the proposed regulations. PPG requested a reconsideration of that and submitted additional material. A meeting was later held between PPG officials and EPA representatives, and EPA concluded that its original determination was still, in fact, in effect. In April of 1977, PPG, as permitted under EPA's regulations, formally asked for a, quote, determination of construction, end quote. And along with that, that determination request, which was essentially a request for EPA to reconsider its prior conclusion, PPG submitted a memorandum of law and a memorandum of facts, once again setting out its interpretation. There's no indication here that PPG was ever prevented from adding all of the material it wanted to the record. Nevertheless, EPA determined in June of 77 that its original conclusion still held, that despite further review of the facility and the standards, that the standards were applicable to PPG's facility. PPG subsequently filed a petition for review with the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit, at PPG's request, dismissed the petition for lack of jurisdiction under Section 307(b)(1). The Fifth Circuit concluded that Congress could not have intended to place review of final actions in the courts of appeals where the action by the administrator was based on what it termed was a skeletal record, as in this case. The Fifth Circuit was also apparently quite influenced by the lack of discovery apparatus or the mechanical limitations that were inherent in courts of appeals versus district courts. And on that basis, the Fifth Circuit read final action very narrowly. They did not provide a criteria for interpreting that phrase, however.
Ms. Walsh, do you agree with the characterization of the Fifth Circuit that the record in this case was skeletal?
No, Your Honor. We believe that it was sufficient for EPA to make the determination that was involved. Granted, in comparison to administrative records in other cases where the issue involved, the legal issue and the factual matters are much more extensive, it was a small as compared to numerous boxes of material. But
isn't the real question, though, not whether it was sufficient for EPA to make the determination, but whether it was sufficient for the Fifth Circuit to determine whether the EPA had acted correctly?
Well, it's that analysis of the record goes both ways. Was it substantively on the merits, was it sufficient to uphold EPA's decision? But the primary question, I suppose, is was it, if record size is a criteria of jurisdiction or a determination of jurisdiction, then that would be the appropriate question. We contend that, however, that's not the criteria for determining jurisdiction. And on that basis, it would not be necessary to analyze the size or the quantity of the record.
In your view, if the record is one which is sufficient to satisfy the agency, is it automatically sufficient for appellate review in the Court of Appeals? Does it always follow that then it is sufficient for the reviewing court?
Not necessarily, in that if there is a record and the administrator's decision must be based on a record to be sustainable, certainly. Now, Congress has provided that on petitions for review, there will be a sufficient record presented to the courts of appeals under 28 U.S.C. 2113. That specifies what the agency must certify to the court of appeals on a petition for review, and that then constitutes the reviewable record, and that assures, contrary to what the Fifth Circuit assumed in this instance, that a reviewable record will always be presented to the an appellate court. Now, if that standard can't be met, if there is no record to certify, then on that basis there would not be a jurisdiction over that particular action.
Well, let's assume that in a particular case the agency considers the record adequate, but the Court of Appeals, asked to review it, concludes that it is inadequate. Just assume that I take it you'd agree that could happen.
Yes.
As it did here now. Could the Court of Appeals appoint a special master or a referee to take testimony to fulfill the function that might have been fulfilled by a district court? Any inherent power in a Court of Appeals to do that?
Well, I believe that I would assume that option would be available to the Court of Appeals. The way to interpret the statute is that what is necessary to supplement the record to determine whether the administrator's action was sustainable or not would be remanded to the agency for supplementation, or the other options that would be available to the Court of Appeals, which might in some instances be the appointment of a special master.
That's the obvious alternative, isn't it?
Yes.
Always.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yet one of your arguments is that you want to speed up the process of review so people will know what is expected of them under the EPA. And if the Court of Appeals remands to the agency, that certainly isn't going to speed up the process.
But what we're concerned with is speeding up the certainly speeding up the application and determining the finality of the administrator's actions. Now, we're not saying that this is a way that EPA gets by making decisions on inadequate records. Certainly not. But without tying jurisdiction to record size, that hurdle, that initial hurdle of the analysis of the record as the determiner of jurisdiction is removed. Now, certainly that doesn't remove the necessity to analyze the record on its substance under the judicial review of the administrator's actions as supported by that record.
Well, I had read the Fifth Circuit's opinion in its use of the word skeletal, not as meaning that it was less than 20 pages or less than 15 pages, but skeletal in the sense that it was simply a correspondence largely between the private party and the EPA, and it was skeletal for purposes of review.
Well, on the basis that certainly there is that indication in the Fifth Circuit's opinion. However, on the basis of what it termed the skeletal record, it refused to take jurisdiction, determining that the skeletal quality of the record is what prevented it under Section 307(b)(1) from taking jurisdiction, which then, under the Fifth Circuit's opinion, and reading the Fifth Circuit's opinion and reading what the Fifth Circuit did, means that analyzing the record and the skeletal or non-skeletal quality of it is the basis on which jurisdiction must originally be determined under Section 307(b)(1). So I think the Fifth Circuit's characterization of the record has to be recognized as first going to jurisdiction as well as to the substance of the record. The reason that we feel that the Section 307(b)(1) must be determined to place original and exclusive review over all final actions in the courts of appeals is that, as I've indicated, this is a final and definite way of determining jurisdiction from the outset. And this serves the purpose not merely of EPA, and probably EPA is the last party that this serves, but most importantly, this facilitates actions moving through the courts in the courts of appeals. It does not cause for an inefficient waste of time in either the district court or the courts of appeals.
Can I ask you a question about the final? I must confess, I know the parties don't argue this, but I have some question about the finality of the June 8th letter itself. That's the order, the final agency action that's under review, the June 8, 1977 letter. That refers to the fact that the agency refuses to change the position it expressed in its October 5th, 1976 letter. One thing I'd like to know is whether you regard the October 5th, 1976 letter as also having been final agency action.
I would say that, yes, it would be. It could have been considered final agency action because that certainly is.
It's just as final as the June 8th letter was.
Yes. The reason why the June 8th is characterized as final action, certainly for these purposes, is that the October letter indicated that it was the agency's final decision, but I believe it also referred to the fact that if PPG had any further questions or requested
it was still open to PPG after the June 8th letter to ask further questions because they had further correspondence, and then on August 18th they got still another final agency action, didn't they? And don't we have three different letters, each of which has an equal claim to finality? That is, at the moment it was received.
Yes, I believe so. If PPG had made no requests or had submitted a petition for review after receiving the October letter, that would have constituted final agency action that was reviewable. Now, EPA and PPG kept open the reconsideration of the determination at that point, with PPG supplying further information,
requesting
further hearings.
Couldn't PPG today write another letter and say, we've got another idea, we're only use 90% oil and 10% gas or something like this? Would that change the situation? If you wrote back and said, no, we adhere to our October 5th, 1976 position, would that also be a final action?
In the sense that they could now file another petition for review on that basis? No, because it would be the same determination that's involved, and we're already involved with the petition for review on the particular
action. Because of the fact they filed a petition for review, is that the reason?
Yes, but there's been no change in the particular agency action involved. Now, under the
there
section,
was none between 77 and 76 either, was there?
No, not between June and the subsequent June letter, which reaffirmed the October decision. By referring to the later determination, we give the advantage to PPG or to whatever affected a party. Now, there is a provision in the Section 307(b)(1) that I would like to emphasize, and that's the publication provision. Congress specified, because of problems that had previously been encountered in the Act as to what the proper filing time was, since there is a cutoff date as to when the filing can be made, that the administrator was to publish in the Federal Register notice of the publications, actions, determinations, and that the time to seek or file a petition for review would start 60 days from that notice. Now, as EPA recognizes in this case, there was no Federal Register publication. EPA's policy, which they have reiterated now, is to publish all the determinations. The only problem is that it goes to the how long the affected party has available to seek a petition for review. In this instance situation, the effect was that it worked to the advantage of PPG. In other words, that 60-day time period never started running.
But would the October 5th determination, say there had been a criminal proceeding or something like that later on, and if there's a failure to seek review of a final action which is subject to review in the Court of Appeals, as I remember the statute, you cannot attack the determination. If there were no publication in the Federal Register and no review sought from the October 5th, 76 proceeding, and sometime in October or November, you'd start a criminal proceeding. Could they have attacked the action in such a proceeding?
Yes, they could have, because there was the opportunity for review remains open if that federal notice has never been published. Now, and an enforcement action is brought, we would contend that the circumstance or the scenario at that point would be to they can still file for a petition for review of the administrator's action under 307(b)(1), and that probably the enforcement proceeding should be held in abeyance pending that determination. But that foreclosure effect of 307(b)(2) does not go into effect because the opportunity to challenge it still remains open. That's why EPA is making efforts to see that all of its final actions will be published in the Federal Register.
Of course, if we held that these actions, these letters back and forth, were not final actions within the meaning of the Act, then the company would always be free in an enforcement proceeding to challenge them.
Yep, because they would not have been reviewable under 307B1. Finality is a prerequisite for jurisdiction. Certainly, if it's not final, then neither the Court of Appeals nor the District Court under principles of administrative law would be able to review it.
Is there any statute or regulation that would preclude EPA from changing its position on any of these anytime it changed its mind?
Having once made it, in other words,
yeah,
going back...
Yeah, any one of these letters. Could they 30 days later said, oh, we reexamined it, and we think we've got a little different approach now, and we're going to take a different position. Is there anything in the statute to prevent them from doing that?
No.
See, in finality under a court proceeding, for example, after a certain number of days goes by, the judge can't change his mind.
Right.
But here, as I understand it, the agency is free to change its mind whenever it wants to.
Well, assuming that it's always acting in accordance with the statutory requirements.
In the best understanding of the law and the material before it and all the rest. But these are complicated matters, and they're...
Exactly.
They're often asked to reexamine by additional letters and additional data on the when the actual facility was built and all this sort of stuff.
And if that would happen, then the affected party would have the opportunity to seek review of the final actions.
And the agency could change its ruling at any time. There's no time limit on when it can change its ruling.
No, the agency is not precluded from
changing
the regulations.
But it's nevertheless a final action within the meaning of the statute.
Because that particular action, and this goes more to the merits of the action that are involved, determined that the new source performance standards would be applicable to the facility at that point. And
well, what you're saying is that it does not lose, the agency does not lose jurisdiction after it's taken a purported final action and an appeal has been filed in the Court of Appeals. Unlike a district court, for example, would have lost jurisdiction and could not, except by leave of the Court of Appeals, modify findings or decree. But you say the agency does not lose jurisdiction even after it's pronounced a final action in the cases in the Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor. I would say, I wouldn't characterize it as a purported final action. It's EPA's final determination. Certainly, as this case represents, there's been no determination of the applicability of the new source performance standards, to my knowledge, for the other emission categories, such as the nitrogen oxides, and a subsequent final action by EPA or a decision that those regulations apply to the PPG facility.
Now, in your brief, you concede that under one of our former cases, even if the action of EPA is final action and therefore subject to an appellate review, it may not be ripe for appellate review. Do I read your footnote correctly?
Yes, Your Honor. Right.
Well, then if they remand it, if the Court of Appeals would simply say this is not ripe for judicial review, appellate review, then that would be subject, presumably, to examination here to see whether we agreed that it was not ripe. Is that so?
That would be subject to examination here, or the Court of Appeals would have the option, certainly, of remanding to the agency for the completion of the administrative proceedings or further administrative hearings, whatever is involved. The critical factor and the issue that we're directed at today is that the ripeness or the substantiality of the record of supporting the administrator's decision, does not go to determining jurisdiction under 307B1. The language of 307B1, that the indication in the intent of Congress is that jurisdiction be a definite concept, and the way to make it a definite concept, consistent with reading the statute, is to make exactly what the section says, to make all final actions reviewable in the courts of appeals.
I suppose if the Court of Appeals had said in this case, this is not ripe for review, EPA could then have proceeded to expand the record. But in this case, you were not in a position, do you say, to expand the record because they said there was no
jurisdiction? No, they said that it was... They said it was not... They had no jurisdiction because it was not a reviewable record under 307B1 for courts of appeals purposes. And they very much left the the parties, both parties, in the lurch. And I think that that must be the what will happen in every case based on the Fifth Circuit's decision. Because they say that the record that was involved lacked some magic quality that would make it reviewable. Now, the option that's available to the Court of Appeals or the District Court in reviewing administrative action under this Court's line of cases is remand to the agency. So the Fifth Circuit's concentration on the discovery apparatus or the mechanical limitations inherent in the Courts of Appeals was really irrelevant because neither the Court of Appeals nor the District Court had that option available to them when reviewing the administrative record. Therefore, the most efficient way to interpret Section 307B1 and the way that's consistent with the integrity of the statute, the statutory language, is to read it as a definite earmarker determination of jurisdiction in the courts of appeals. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Well, Mr. Leto.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, we disagree directly on the construction to be given the other final action catchphrases at the end of those two sentences at the beginning of Section 307B1. But every once in a while, one of the old Latin statutory construction phrases makes sense and applied in the modern context to the federal statutory construction problems. We think this is a classic case, actually, for application of the doctrine of statutory construction justum generis to construe the catchphrase at the end of a statutory series like those that are similar to it in the enumeration that precedes it. But the key thing, I think, that the Court has to remember in focusing on this case is that the agency is arguing for original, exclusive, and preclusive jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals, that Section 307B2 bars anybody from raising an issue in the enforcement proceedings or anything that would come along subsequently if that issue could have been raised under a direct review action under Section 307B1. Now, I recognize that in this particular case, the briefing might not be especially helpful. At least the opening brief of EPA is cryptic. Our responsive brief and EPA's reply are really where the arguments are found. In addition to the problems of just discussing the type of action that took place in this case, whether it's final, we believe that EPA has misread seriously three statutory provisions as well as our position in the case. What I'd like to do is take a few minutes at the outset and summarize our arguments and position and perhaps work the case into context and then focus on detailed points. I'd remind the Court that Congress established the special judicial review provisions in 1970. It mandated at that time review in the courts of appeals for certain specifically enumerated actions. Other actions were definitely at that time reviewed in district courts under the generally applicable federal question jurisdictional grant and then the Administrative Procedure Act. Those other actions, or the actions that were brought in district court, included actions to review the application of the new source standards. In fact, the application of the new source standards at issue in this particular case. There were a series of district court actions that took place between 1970 and 1977 on these precise types of matters. In 1977, however, Congress added a number of further specific sections to the listing that was in Section 307, and it added those other final action catchwords at the end of the two sentences. Now, EPA's arguments are based on the broadest conceivable reading of those other final action catchwords. They're so broad that they would make the specific listing that precedes it redundant and useless. The words, the special enumeration, might as well not be there at all. You can construe the other final catchwords, other final action catchwords, in light of the enumeration, however, because that specified list of actions, both in the first sentence and the second one, deal with a consistent class of actions. Those actions, if you look at them and analyze them in detail, all are either rulemaking actions or they're adjudications where EPA has to act on the basis of an opportunity for a hearing to the affected party. And that opportunity for a hearing brings into play the formal adjudication provisions of Section 554 of the APA, and it ensures that the Court of Appeals has a record available to it for review. And accordingly, and make no mistake about it, our position on jurisdiction is in no way unclear. In short, and I'd like to reiterate it again, we say that a usedom generis construction of the other final action catchwords would include either EPA action, which is rulemaking, or adjudication where the statute on its face provides an opportunity for a hearing, bringing into play Section 554 of the Administrative Procedure Act. We recognize, or the rulemaking, by the way, would either have to be subject to Section 553 of the Administrative Procedure Act or to the further provisions that actually in the Clean Air Act in Section 307D that displace the Administrative Procedure Act's provisions and are more stringent in certain respects, especially insofar as keeping a docket and making a record. Now, we recognize that this usedom generis construction of the other final action catchwords would not include the Section 112 reference in the listing in the second sentence, because Section 112, while it refers to hazardous substances, does not call for an opportunity for a hearing on the part of the private party. Section 12, however, deals with three different kinds of actions. It deals with an approval by EPA, or actually EPA, not a state, of an application or a notice for permission to either build or modify a plant that emits hazardous pollutants. In the second part, it deals with violations of hazardous pollutants, and in third part, it deals with waivers from that hazardous pollutant standard. Section 112C does require in each of these three instances that EPA make statutorily defined findings before it takes its action. And accordingly, we believe that Section 112C's provisions can be taken into account in a usedom generis construction of these other final action catchwords if the court wants to, because it could add to the categories of adjudication which are covered by those catchwords those actions which are taken by EPA where the statute expressly requires that certain determinations or factual findings to be made in support of its action. We don't think, and the reason we don't put that forward as a favored construction of the statute, is that Section 112C is an exceptional provision in the statute. This Court's had the Adamo Wrecking case before it. It knows that the Act has special provisions for enforcement as well as judicial review for hazardous pollutants. And we think that Section 112C is an exception, and you don't need to include it within this usedom generis class. But either way, whether the Court would adopt the optional construction or not, you wouldn't reach the action in the present case, because here you don't have any requirement at all stated in the statute that EPA make these types of final determinations. We do agree with EPA that it is a final determination. PPG had to build, or was in the process of building that plant. It was just about built at the time this all started. And indeed, it had to know whether or not those standards in the fossil fuel fire generating unit requirements that the EPA had put forward were applicable or not. It had to govern its conduct by them as it operated this particular plant. We do think, in construing the statute, that the Court should be particularly concerned about EPA's most expansive reading, because it would really have a strong adverse effect on judicial administration. You'd heavily burden the courts of appeals with review of actions that by EPA that were taken outside the administrative record. As Professor Curry points out, any time you have an adjudication that does not take place under Section 554, the agency can go outside the administrative record and grasp grounds for its decision.
Well, your alternative would burden the district courts rather than the courts of appeals.
No, it wouldn't necessarily, Justice Rehnquist, for two reasons. The first is that you're going to have many more petitions for review filed in the courts of appeals under this reading than you are any other reading of the statute, and that's because of the review preclusion provisions. You're going to have people who realize that they only have one chance to get review unless they carry forward any possible claim they might have within the 60-day time period. They lose, under the Yakis case, the right to review of those issues entirely. You've got to remember that.
Why wouldn't that be equally true with respect to the district courts?
Because if you were in the district court, you would be outside the reach of Section 307B1. And Section 307B1 and Section 3, in the judicial review provisions, and Section 307B2 in the review preclusion provisions have a juxtaposed scope. The review preclusion provisions get carried along or drug along by the coverage of the judicial review provisions. So if you were in district court, you wouldn't be in under the special review provisions at all.
I see.
And the second reason, though, is, as this court has pointed out in the Overton Park case, a district court can use discovery means. It has those procedures available to prove out the non-record aspects of the agency action. It can use them. It doesn't have to use discovery in aid of a trial of de novo facts, but it uses the discovery to prove out the basis for the agency's action.
But under the government's reading of the statute, where it concedes the Court of Appeals can remand, couldn't the Court of Appeals remand for similar supplementation of the agency record?
Your Honor, it could, but as Justice Marshall's opinion in the Overton Park case where the court points out, I think it's at page 420, anytime you remand to the agency, when you've got a circumstance like that, you're going to risk post hoc rationalization. And the opinion in the Overton Park case warns that you don't give deference, or the court doesn't give deference to what results from the remand because of that danger. Now, the Fifth Circuit was acutely aware of that.
Did the opinion leave open the right of the district court to send it back?
Yes, it did. It definitely did that. Yes. But you warned that that might be a consequence of it.
I warned the court did.
Yes. But in any event, what we're saying is the Fifth Circuit was acutely aware of this because it had had a case called Save the Bay.
What's wrong with a little post-rationalization?
I thought we remanded sometimes because somebody hadn't rationalized enough.
Well, Your Honor, we tried.
We send them back and say, look, it's fine if you want to reach this result if you just give some reasons. You didn't give enough reasons. Now give some, and they post-rationalize and send it back.
We would have liked to have had some reasons for the application of the new source standards in this particular case that focused on the particular requirements that were placed on the waste heat boilers, because as the court knows from looking at the briefs and the record, these are not your standard everyday boilers. They fit in the midst of a cogeneration system where the actual air feed to the boilers is the turbine exhaust gas. You cannot measure as a consequence the pollutants in the exhaust, if you will, from the waste heat boilers and get the numbers for the pollutant parameters that are actually specified in EPA's new source standards, because you have a combination of the pollutants from the supplemental fuel there along with those from the turbines, which are completely separate and apart. And EPA, as a consequence, couldn't directly apply the new source standards in this case. One of our problems has always been that it applied special ad hoc requirements that we say are not specified in the statute and indeed at that time were not authorized. But we never have really gotten to that claim or focused on the particular difference between a waste heat boiler and a cogeneration system and a regular boiler, because we've been arguing about, among other things, jurisdiction and review.
If you weren't, you might have gotten to it.
Beg your pardon, Your Honor? I didn't hear.
You might have gotten to the merits if you weren't fighting about jurisdiction.
Well, at the time we filed, and this goes back to the timing of the particular letters, you have to realize that we had a letter on August 3rd that basically said the requirements applied only at the time we were operating, or PPG was operating those boilers. with 100% fossil fuel, no input from the, or no waste heat from the turbines at all. And then the Clean Air Act was actually passed or enacted by the President's signature on August 7th. Then we get the letter of August 18th that says we were wrong on August 3rd. What we're really going to do is apply the new source standards, and we're going to apply these specific ad hoc requirements without necessarily any statement of reasons by the agency for doing that.
You and the government perhaps have different views of what the universe of reviewable matters would contain. So I suppose you might have a different view if 99.9% of the final judgments really would have an adequate record. I take it you think that an awful lot of them wouldn't have an adequate record.
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't think so. I think there are a lot of informal actions that EPA takes that do have an adequate record for review.
I know a lot of them, but I take it you must think that an awful lot of them wouldn't have enough.
In this particular case, the agency could have had an adequate record for review. In fact, following along with a question that Justice Stevens had asked earlier, after we got the August 18th letter, we went back to the agency and had a meeting at which we tried to discuss the particular ad hoc requirements that were imposed that weren't set out in the standard. And we did not get any resolution of that. There were no letters written. There's no correspondence at all that's reflected in the administrative record in this particular case. If we would have gotten a series of, again, amendments, if you will, to the final order to take those further matters into account, then I think we would have come closer to having an adequate record for review. But that was in part why, especially the Court of Appeals said, we don't know why they chose these particular requirements. It's a skeletal record insofar as that's concerned.
So
but
you think that if the EPA really does its work, they probably can have an adequate record in almost any case?
Yes, Your Honor, even if it's informal adjudication.
So we should let the possibility of an inadequate record just because of ineptness send all these cases to the district court?
No, Your Honor. Justice White, that is why we put forward very carefully a bright line, usum generis construction of those catchwords at the end of the statute. This problem didn't arise prior to the 1977 amendments. Because you had Court of Appeals exclusive and preclusive jurisdiction limited to specific enumerated actions. And as I said, those actions were either rulemaking or they were adjudication where the agency on the statute had a responsibility to provide the affected party with an opportunity for hearing unless you brought Section 554 of the APA into play. And it's only when you get these unclear and ambiguous words, other final action, that you have a problem. And we think those words are ambiguous only standing alone. Because if you take the context of the section, Section 307B1, and what happened in 1970, in particular, when Congress put that in place, because Congress at that time put it in place with a careful recognition that it was applying the special review listing only to actions which would have an adequate record for review in the courts of appeals, with what the action that it actually took in 1977, you do not get the very broadest possible reading that EPA has put forward. Instead, you get a justum generis construction. That is, the other final action really means things that are like the things that are in the listing, anything.
You don't think the special review proceeding depends on whether going to the Court of Appeals depends on an ad hoc evaluation of the record, but that the likelihood of a skeletal record is why you apply the justum generis construction.
Precisely. That's precisely right. We agree with the agency completely.
The likelihood of somebody having made a mistake.
Well, we, Justice White, we agree with the agency completely that you need a bright line jurisdictional rule. You need something that you can tell on the face of the statute before you even go into one of these proceedings whether or not you're going to be subject to it at the end, exclusive and preclusive review in the courts of appeals, or whether you're not, and you can raise defenses in enforcement cases or go to the district court for review if you want to.
Well, if you could predict that only about 1 out of 1,000 might final actions might have an insufficient record because somebody made a mistake, it certainly isn't much of an argument for your construction.
But Justice White, the application of EPA's rule would mean that you'd have everything from, I think of EPA's decision to blacklist a company from federal contracts. It's informal adjudication, doesn't have a record attached to it. You could have, I suppose, if EPA ever gets to the point where it puts up auto inspection stations in those states that won't do it themselves for emission requirements, individual cars going through that auto inspection station. That would be a final action by the agency, certainly, at least insofar as that particular car is concerned.
Mr. Leto, I want to be sure I understand. What you think the phrase, any other final action in the present 307B1 means, you say, justum generis, it means actions of similar to those which are specifically enumerated.
Yes, that's precisely right. And we think that...
And because those would could be expected to have adequate records to provide intelligent review, informed review on the part of the Court of Appeals. Is that it?
That's precisely it, and that's the criteria that the Congress
used. Not whether in this case there is an adequate record.
No.
Not in whether in any particular case there is an adequate record.
No, not at all. That's precisely right. You can take this statute and you can construe it, I suppose, without regard to the facts of this particular case, because jurisdictionally, we think on any proper justum generis construction of the statute, we would fall outside the special court of
appeals. And that would, would include then what?
It would include rulemaking, because the actions both in the first and second sentence do include some rulemaking actions.
And it would include all rulemaking.
That's right. And because they're either subject to 553 of the APA or the special provisions of Section 307D.
Mm-hmm.
And it would include also those adjudications which EPA has to take which are subject to statutorily the right of an affected party to request
a hearing,
to provide the opportunity for a hearing, and there you actually bring into play Section 554.
And
as I mentioned,
record.
That's right. There's one exception, and that's 112C, which deals with hazardous pollutants. And that is the only exception. EPA has raised a couple of other sections, which they say are also exceptions. They have raised, in particular, sections 111J and 119 as not fitting the statutory scheme or plan that we have put forward. We think it misstates those provisions. Section 111J authorizes innovative technology waivers from new source standards. EPA says it requires an opportunity for a hearing only where the agency grants relief, but there's no opportunity for a hearing where it denies it, and so it doesn't fit. But the statutory language actually says the administrator may grant a waiver after notice and opportunity for public hearing. And given this context, we have a great deal of difficulty with how EPA could possibly decide in advance of proceedings whether or not it would ultimately grant or deny relief. It has to gather the facts, including by a hearing, and then decide, as the statute says, after notice and hearing. The same problem in exactly arises with...
Well, you're not saying that we have to conduct a hearing.
No.
If I posted a notice and nobody showed up at the time for a hearing, the guy doesn't have to sit there for 3 hours and twiddle his thumbs.
No, that's precisely right. But that isn't the criteria even for bringing Section 554 into play. It's just providing an opportunity for a public hearing. And indeed, 554, as the Court well knows, provides summary judgment opportunities in the administrative context and other things too, but it's the fact that the statute provides an opportunity for a hearing that distinguishes it. Section 119 is precisely the same. It provides after notice and a hearing on the record in several instances. In other words, you get an opportunity for a hearing under Section 119 as well, and we think the agency's putting forward this grant-deny dichotomy is a misreading of the statute, and that those two sections do fit within this general plan. And as a matter of fact, courts of appeals have actually made such construction. They have used this justum generis idea, but from a reverse vantage point. They've construed the substantive provisions that are actually listed in the special judicial review provision in light of the record desired for Court of Appeals review. An example, and it's not cited in our brief, is the Marathon Oil case at 564 F. 2nd 1253. In that case, the court had before it the question whether the hearing required for a Clean Water Act discharge permit was a formal adjudicatory hearing under Section 554 or whether EPA could dispense with the hearing requirement, cross-examination, or particular requirements during the hearing.
Mr. Leto, with respect to this, the precise issue now before us, this may all be in your brief, yeah, but I read them some time ago, and it's not in my mind. Have the courts of appeals, have any other courts of appeals besides this one addressed this issue?
Not this precise issue. They have addressed certainly the scope of the judicial review provisions, but you have the references, for example, to the Utah Power case.
Yes, Judge that's Levin's here in the District Columbia Court.
That's right. And the Chrysler case under the Noise Act and the Crown Simpson case under the Water Act, they have been consistent in adopting strict and precise and carefully crafted narrow interpretations because particularly of the review preclusion aspects that get carried along with them, and also the difficulty of the record posed by, or the record problems posed by review.
But on this precise issue, there's no other Court of Appeals decision.
No, but as I'm about to point out.
But you say on the general, generic question, there are other courts of appeals decisions which are not in conflict but rather are consistent.
That's precisely right. And in fact, the Marathon Oil case is one of them because in that case, the court construed the reference, the substantive provisions reference listing in the special judicial review provisions to have some impact on what those actual requirements were for that particular substantive statute. And the court said, actually quoted from the Attorney General's manual on the APA on the subject, and the Attorney General's manual had said that a requirement that administrative decisions be on the record can be clearly implied in the provision for judicial review in the circuit courts of appeal. That was where the actual statute called for a hearing but didn't say whether you had on the record such that you would also bring 554 into play. And decisions that are consistent with Marathon Oil are the U.S. Steel case in the Seventh Circuit and the First Circuit Seacoast Anti-Pollution League case. Those are at 556 F. 2nd and 572 F. 2nd, respectively. So the courts have used this justum generis idea, but they've used it from the reverse vantage point. There's one final thing I'd particularly like to cover, and that's that EPA's broad construction would actually introduce an internal conflict into Section 307 itself. As the Court knows, in the first section of Section 307, the Courts of Appeals are to review, among other things, and it says EPA's action in promulgating any standard under Section 202 of the Act, but then right away a parenthetical clause appears, other than a standard required to be prescribed under Section 202B1 of the Act. This section deals with auto emission standards. EPA's broad reading of the catchphrase in the sentence would actually draw back into the ambit of Court of Appeals review that item which is specifically excluded by the parenthetical exemption. EPA argues in its reply brief that Section 202B1, the parenthetically exempted part of the statute, doesn't call on the agency to take any action which is reviewable in any court. That's wrong, and that's wrong for the reasons that are stated in Professor Curry's report to the Administrative Conference, which actually produced the recommendations that went to Congress and formed the basis for the 1977 amendments. As Professor Curry had pointed out, Section 202 does require or does have in it particular provisions which call for numbers in auto pollution standards. Those numbers, for example, are things like 1.5 grams per vehicle mile of hydrocarbons. But in every case, the statute says that EPA standards may not exceed that level. In other words, EPA standards can be more stringent. And as Professor Curry points out in his report, which is in the Iowa Law Review, it's reprinted there, you have to have court review, or you have to have the opportunity for court review, whether or not EPA properly exercised its power to make the standards more stringent than the statutorily set levels or not. And he had concluded at that point that the only possibility of review, of course, was in district court under the federal question statutes and the Administrative Procedure Act, so a review had to be available there. And we agree wholeheartedly. We also note that Section 202B1 has...
Yes, I don't follow. Why would it be necessary to have review of the question whether the standard was sufficiently stringent?
When EPA sets the standard, it doesn't necessarily set it at the precise numerical level.
Right.
It can go more at a level more stringent than
if
that.
It's too
depending
stringent,
on,
then the company would seek review. But if it's not stringent enough,
you could have an environmental group coming in and saying you have factual evidence.
What demands that there be such review?
The possibility that just because the statute does not fix the standard, it allows discretion. Admittedly, it only allows it one way.
What you're saying is if there's to be review on behalf of an environmental group, that'll have to be in the district court.
Yes.
There's no such review provided in the Court of Appeals.
That's exactly right. And on the other hand, if they set a more stringent standard and the auto companies challenge it, again, that review has to be in district court. And moreover, EPA completely ignores the fact that the 1977 amendments changed.
Why couldn't that review be regional rather than national, the second half of the section?
Well, because the action obviously would have a national impact. I don't think there's much claim that the action itself would not have a nationwide scope. It certainly wouldn't be focused, as this was, on a particular plant in one city, and that is Lake Charles, Louisiana. But the thing that is missed is that the statute was amended in 77 to add the requires EPA to prescribe substitute emission standards for certain small manufacturers of light-duty vehicles and also to deal with evaporative emissions of hydrocarbons. You can deal with these two things also by calling for district court review, having the justum generis construction of the catchphrase reflect the particular exemption that's in the particular item in the series. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Ms. Walsh, do you have anything further?
I'd like to try and show some of the shadows on PPG's bright line of justum generis. First of all, as we discussed in our reply brief, there are certain actions that the administrator can take under the Act that are specified in the enumerated portions of 307B1 that would not necessarily be based on a complete formal record, the type that PPG requires. I think one of the mistakes that PPG makes is they assume that every time you have an action made on a record, that there will be an opportunity for a hearing and a hearing that's conducted. The Administrative Procedure Act in Section 553, providing for rulemaking, requires that rulemaking proceed on a notice and an opportunity for hearing. And that opportunity for hearing may consist of just the type of action taken in this case, that is the submission of data, the transfer of correspondence between the agency and the party involved. In other words, PPG assumes, reads into the statute things that are not there, the requirement of of what they would call a complete and presumably an APA record in reference to the justum generis provisions of 307. It's not provided in the APA. They're asking more than the APA does. The types of actions that Congress referred to in those enumerated sections are not necessarily the types of actions that would be based on a record after a formal hearing. So that looking to justum generis, which is no more than an aid to construction, it certainly should not be referred to as a controlling interpretive principle for this important provision of the Act. Looking to the justum generis does not provide us with a clear, definite way of interpreting the statute. Of necessity, it requires a reference to at least one, if not two, courts before there's a final, possibly three courts, before there's a final determination of jurisdiction. The question was asked as to the burden that would be put on courts of appeals under our reading of the statute if all reference is made to courts of appeals on petitions for review. Certainly, PPG's reference or interpretation does not ease the load on the courts. It allows for application to a district court. If the district court's analysis of the record or determination of jurisdiction is incorrect,
yes,
there would be...
It's a good deal. It makes quite a bit of difference if you're dividing the possible work up among 100 districts and as compared with 11 courts of appeals.
First of all...
Let's suppose that there were 20,000 final judgments, final orders every year of EPA. Just assume that. I don't know. A lot of courts, some of the courts of appeals are pretty heavy, pretty deep underwater. More so perhaps than 100 district courts.
We certainly recognize that, and that's why we're looking for an interpretation of the statute that would not overly burden the courts.
But each decision under the EPA by the district court is appealable to the court.
Certainly. That's just what I was going to point out, that decision in and of itself would be appealable.
Also, but they aren't. They aren't. What percentage of judgments are appealed, Ms. Walsh?
I can't give you a definite statistic.
You won't tell me that's all of them are.
No, I would not indicate that. Certainly, the possibility is there for a large percentage. I would point out that the PPG's brief made a reference to...
Possibly all of them would be, but they aren't.
Everyone is appealable. They're not.
And not even half of them.
I'm not sure as to that amount, but the possibility is there for reference to one, if not two, courts. The definite possibility, the thing we can say with certainty, is that when a final action is involved, we have an uncertain determination of jurisdiction under PPG's interpretation of the statute.
First, Ms. Walsh, if we held that the action was not final, then it wouldn't have to burden either court.
That possibility is there. Anytime you have administrative action, the possibility of it being non-final and no court being burdened is there.
Neither party nor did the Court of Appeals find it was... If there's any question about its finality.
I'd like to know what the closest case you know of to holding finality in an order like this. The cases you cite aren't very close.
On the basis of a record,
this kind of
on the basis
being
of
a final order.
Do you mean as to the application of the regulations or this particular
the letter
record?
Of June 8, 1977. It's the closest thing to that you've ever seen appealed to this court.
It would seem to me that Camp versus Pitts, that where the record was based on a request for a determination by the comptroller, the determination was made on the exchange of correspondence, would be the most similar.
Camp versus Pitts.
Yes.
Well, if this had been a litigated issue, maybe you would have tried a little harder to...
It's possible that the finality of it...
Since everybody agrees with it, you...
We were concerned with jurisdiction, which we believe is, according to our interpretation.
Of course, we have an independent duty to satisfy ourselves, don't
yes.
we?
Yes, Your Honor. We would ask that the Fifth Circuit be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Thank you, Mr. Leto. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...